It's 12:37. High pressure building into the Midwest is providing us with sunshine and warmer temperatures. As the high moves to the east tomorrow, a major warming trend will begin with temperatures climbing well above average. Then tomorrow evening, a cold front will approach from the west, bringing with it a chance for scattered showers and thunderstorms tomorrow evening and Friday. Highs today will range from the mid-50s across northern Indiana to the mid-60s across central Missouri. Lows overnight will range from the upper 50s in central Missouri to the upper 30s in southern Michigan. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, sunny with a high of 50. The wind from the southwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 44 and a south wind from 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, warm and breezy with a high of 68. The wind will be from the south at 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts to 30. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low of 54. Friday, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms and a high in the low 60s. Friday night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 30s. Saturday, sunny with a high in the mid 50s. Saturday night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 40s. And the outlook for Sunday, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 50s. Temperatures across Illinois and Indiana at noon central time ranged from the low to mid-50s, both states seeing sunshine. At Rockford and Chicago's O'Hare Airport, as well as Mattoon, 54 degrees, 52 at Bloomington, 55 at Carbondale. At South Bend, it was 51, 53 at Lafayette, Indianapolis, and Evansville. Terre Haute checked in with 52. At noon at Willard, sunny, 53 degrees. The dew point, 44. The relative humidity, 71%. The wind out of the southwest at 8. The barometric pressure, 30.17 and falling. And at 12:39, 55 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. In Egypt, finding politicians to run the country with the requisite experience and who aren't out of favor with the public is a challenge. NPR Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep is in Cairo following the story. He spoke with NPR reporter Soraya Sahardi Nelson about the controversial referendum scheduled for a vote March 19th that will determine who will run the country and what kind of powers the president will have.
The military-backed government that took over this country says it's removing an obstacle to democracy. It has, at least in a formal sense, disbanded the state security agency that spied on and oppressed people. The move comes just before Egyptians vote on a constitution and start political campaigns. And we're going to talk through all this with NPR's Soraya Sahardi Nelson. Hi, Soraya.
Hi, Steve.
What does it mean to disband an agency whose spies are everywhere?
Well, this is the big question that many people have. Certainly, this is what protesters wanted. They wanted this agency to go away completely. But many fear this may also just be a word game, if you will, because there's discussion of building a new force that will have similar functions, although it will be less focused on spying on the people.
So it's going to be a new agency, different name, possibly some of the same people?
That is what the great fear is. The feeling is also that this was a carrot that's being offered to Egyptians in order to entice them to the polls this weekend.
Well, let's talk about that. On Saturday now, coming right up just in a few days, Egyptians are supposed to vote on constitutional amendments. About half a dozen have been put together by a panel that was backed by the army. And this is the beginning of a pretty fast-moving process here. Right after that, political campaigns begin. There's a vote for parliament. There's a vote for president, assuming the constitutional changes are approved. This is a lot happening fairly quickly. What are people saying about this?
Well, they're very excited about elections, but they have a lot of trepidation about elections, especially the fact that they're moving so quickly. They're excited about some of the names that have emerged, people like Nobel Peace Prize laureate Mohamed El-Beradei and Arab League General Secretary Amr Moussa, as some of the people who've put platforms out there. But at this one cafe that I went to, Horea Cafe, which is very famous for people getting together and having political debates, there was one patron that I spoke to, Fatih Saad, who was one of the many who were expressing how the excitement that they feel over the prospect of elections really is tempered by the fact that it's going to be structured in such a way that perhaps will not allow some of the new voices that are emerging for democracy to be part of it. Saad argues that rushing into elections now is just going to lead to another ruler who's going to control Egypt but not answer to the people. He and many other Egyptians believe time should be given for the revolution's young leaders to form political parties and platforms. But Egypt's military rulers are in no mood to wait. They are charging ahead with a referendum this Saturday on hastily drawn up constitutional amendments. Khaled Fahmy chairs the history department at the American University in Cairo.
Now, as much as we want the army to get out of the picture, we also don't want it to rush things so rapidly that what we end up with is a very faulty system.
He says even top presidential contenders as al-Baradei and Musa opposed the constitutional amendments drafted last month by the military's hand-picked experts. The measures would become part of a temporary constitution that the army can use to turn authority over to a civilian government. But opponents say the amendments have longer-lasting implications because they determine who can run for president and parliament in elections scheduled for later this year. Critics argue the rush only benefits Hosni Mubarak's former colleagues and possibly a few organized political movements because they are already well established. They, in turn, would get to pick the committee that will draft a permanent constitution. So, in effect, Egypt's military rulers are disenfranchising youth leaders and others responsible for the revolution, Fahmy tells us.
The way they did the amendments fell far short of what this revolution really stands for, which is basically consultation and true democracy.
The army-appointed official overseeing the referendum disagrees. Mohamed Atteya says more than half of Egypt's 80 million citizens will be eligible to vote for or against the amendments. He predicts it will be the first referendum to reflect the real will of the Egyptian people.
Okay, that's NPR's Soraya Sarhadi Nelson here in Cairo. Soraya, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep. He's reporting on Egypt this week from Cairo. In Japan, plants that make semiconductors for devices like smartphones are coping with rolling blackouts. Shipping is also a headache as transportation is snarled. NPR's Zoe Chase reports.
If you look inside your iPhone, by turning it on its side and cracking it open like an oyster, I got it.
Wow.
It's open.
Is it shattered everywhere?
Oh my God. Joanna Stern writes for Engadget.com. She's helping me figure out what to look for.
I mean, what it would look like is a chip. Probably greenish.
You'll find what's at the heart of Japan's electronic manufacturing crisis.
It's a 16-gigabyte NAND flash chip.
A 16-gigabyte NAND flash chip. And that's what a lot of people are worried about.
So what that chip actually does is that 16 gigabytes of storage space, 16 gigabytes where you can store your pictures, your videos, whatever it is, your emails, whatever you're saving to your phone.
It may sound small, but believe me, this is a huge industry.
The little flash drives that you can put in your, you know, computer, some people call them computer keys, anything else with sort of smaller storage. So now the new tablets, music players, iPods, Zunes, trying to think of what else I have in my bag right now with some sort of storage in it.
All smartphones use flash storage. Many laptops use flash. All tablets use flash. Digital cameras use flash. Most consumer electronics have some sort of flash storage inside. Everything that's hot right now is using flash. 40% of the world's supply of NAND flash storage comes out of Japan. But it gets worse.
If you take apart an iPhone, you'll see in excess of 100 different components.
Len Gelinek is an analyst with iSupply. Both he and Stern were quick to point out that Japan is responsible for other parts of my phone besides storage, the semiconductors.
Those are the parts that are used in making the microprocessors and are used in making the NAND flash storage and are used in making other parts of the components.
So these semiconductors are completely essential to our phones. Japan produces about one-fifth of the world's semiconductors. Many of those factories are at a standstill, too, because of power outages and earthquake damages. Intel and South Korea's Samsung will pick up the slack. But let's get back to the pieces of phones scattered around me. Yes, many of them could and probably did come from Japan. And they're not being made right now.
If you don't have one of those components, you basically cannot build that phone.
And an earthquake in Japan, that's a large disruption in the supply chain.
And where those shortages will occur, it could be even a little metal screw that is unique to the design of the chassis.
The what?
The phone body.
There will be shortages, Gelinek says, but it's hard to tell of what right now because Japan makes so many electronic components. We have enough finished product to last us about a month, he speculates. But if you're waiting for a discount on a hot new device that uses a NAND flash card, like an iPad 2, think again. You'll be lucky to get it at all this year at full price. Zoe Chase, NPR News.
A new survey shows American workers are increasingly pessimistic that they will be able to retire comfortably. The nonprofit Nonpartisan Employee Benefit Research Institute's 21st annual report on worker confidence finds 27% of Americans are not at all confident that they have been saving enough. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
Jack Vanderhei co-authored the Employee Benefit Research Institute's report on worker confidence. It's a report the nonprofit Nonpartisan Group has been doing for 21 years.
And this year was without a doubt the worst year ever in terms of worker confidence.
The percentage of workers who said they were not confident they could retire comfortably has grown 5% in the past year. The biggest increase was among those who actually are the least prepared for retirement. Vanderhei suspects that with all the economic and housing news in the past year or so, the individuals finally took a hard look at what they had and what they would need.
In previous years, we had a lot of problems with what we call false optimism, and I think realism is starting to finally set in.
So, have they started to save more?
The answer, unfortunately, is not yet.
But Vanderhei hopes their more realistic assessment will prompt them to set aside more money. While individual retirement needs will vary widely, one rule of thumb says you should have a nest egg of about 10 times the amount of your annual earnings. So, if you bring in $50,000 a year, you should plan to have about $500,000 for retirement. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
You'll find thousands of used albums, plus CDs, videotapes, DVDs, and working stereo equipment at the 2011 Vintage Vinyl Sale, held on April 30th. We'll be at the new site, the former Altman's Billiard and Barstool Supply, located at 301 West Market View Drive in Champaign. Proceeds benefit the Illinois Radio Reader.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 16th of March, 2011. The birthday of novelist Alice Hoffman, New York City, 1952. Author most recently of The Red Garden. It came out this year. It's the birthday of the poet Cesar Vallejo, born in Santiago de Chico, Peru, 1892.